let's carry on. The three-quarter interpretation is by Allison in his book. And it's three quarters because he does not think that the full story about universality really does get worked out here. Rather, he thinks some of the preconditions for it get worked out here. And he says that the solution to the circular problem that he already analyzed, a circularity that sounds very much like Ginzburg's own theory, right? Is that it runs together two separate theses. First, that subjective universality that is affirmed in a judgment of taste must be based on a universally communicable mental state. So subjective universality affirmed in a judgment of taste is indeed, based on a universal communicable mental state. But secondly, that mental state derives its universal communicability from its connection with a universal communicable act of judging or reflection, and it is this judging that must logically precede the pleasure. So it's in a way saying, so what he wants to do, what Allison wants to do, is say, Ginzburg is right about the sense that the pleasure must be grounded in a universal communicable state, but the universal communicable state must refer back to a act of judging or reflection that logically precedes the pleasure. So the crux for him, to put it another way, and I can see you're thinking, oh, this is a bit too refined, is how does universality pertain to cognition? And this is actually what Kant discusses on page 217 and 218. So if we go back to 217, the third paragraph still, but now, because we are wild and uncontrollable animals, we're going to go on to the second sentence of the paragraph. Hey, just call me crazy. The second sentence says, and this is what Allison wants to underline, nothing, however, can be communicated universally except cognition, as well as, and now modifying except cognition, as well as presentation insofar as it pertains to cognition. For presentation is objective only insofar as it pertains to cognition, and only through this does it have a universal reference point with which everyone's presentational power is compelled to harmonize. Ah, so So what's Kant saying there? And this is going to be what paragraph 21 is all about. But the claim is simply this. That if we want to explain universality in aesthetics, actually anywhere in this area, it has to relate to cognition. Why? Because cognition really is in the business of stating what is the case for everyone. Right? The chair is green. So something about the universality of aesthetics must relate to the universality that's achieved in cognitive judgment. Well, the universality that is achieved in cognitive judgments, of course, gets its universality from the concept applying to the object, right? So he says, well, let's weaken that by one step. Let's ratchet it down a little bit and say, what pertains to us achieving that cognition? Well, what is he talking about? What pertains to us achieving that cognition? And we may say what he's talking about is the subjective conditions for objective judgment. And the subjective conditions for objective judgment is the way in which the imagination and the understanding are brought into relation, but in a cognition, they're brought into relation via subsumption. Right? By the imaginative state being subsumed, that is the presentation, being subsumed by the conceptuality of universality. Okay? So, yet, and here's the important thing, nonetheless, and this is going to come back in paragraph 21 and in the deduction of taste. So this is all consequential for everything that's going to follow. Nonetheless, we cannot make sense of cognition unless our different faculties get into relationship with one another. Let's call that harmony. Let's call any state in which the imagination and the understanding are working together a harmony of the imagination and the understanding. Now we need somehow to separate aesthetic harmony from cognitive harmony. And what Kant then goes on to say, the third sentence. It's amazing. These sentences just follow one another, almost logically. If, then, we are to think that the judgment about this universal communicability of the presentation has a merely subjective determining basis, that is, let's now forget the fact that the conceptuality is going to bring us a relationship to the object. Let's just drop that relationship to the object by dropping the conceptuality. I.e. one that does not involve the concept of the object. I.e. he just did my erasure, right? That's his erasing. Right? The I.e. is just erasing relationship to the object. Then this basis can be nothing other than the mental state that we find in the relation between the presentational powers, imagine and understanding, insofar as they refer to a given presentation, to cognition in general. So the thought here is that what an aesthetic state is the relation of the imagination to the understanding in general, which is to say, without the determination of a concept. What does that mean? What does that mean? How do we do this in general? Next sentence. But by the way, I mean, I'm doing this, I know I'm just playing games here, but this is how you have to learn to read Kant. The thing about Kant, which is the hardest thing, is although it feels like an argument, you often also feel that they're enthymemes, right? That they're missing steps. And you're right. Kant is the most enthymatic of all writers I know of. So there is a logic, but you have to fill in all the missing steps in order to see how one sentence follows from another. That's really the hard graft of learning to read this song. My friend. My honorable friend. From Königsberg. Okay. When this happens, the cognitive powers brought into play by this presentation are in free play. So the difference between doing it cognitively and doing it without a concept is in a state of aesthetic reflective judging, there is a free play in the relationship between the understanding and the imagination, where free play means no longer determined by any particular conceptuality, but merely by the general demands of harmonization between understanding and imagination. Hence, which is what he then goes on to say in the next few sentences, skip down a paragraph. Hence, this subjective universal communicability. Now, why is it universally communicable? Because it satisfies the general subjective conditions for objective judgment. So one version of the third critique is that it is like looking at cognition from the subjective side. It's instead of looking out towards the world, you look at the, let's call it the mental, the kind of mental activities that must be gotten through for the sake of any judging of an object, but without actually making a judgment. Hence, the subjective universal communicability can mean nothing but that the mental state in which we are, when imagination and understanding are in free play, insofar as they harmonize with each other as required for cognition in general. For we are conscious that this subjective relation suitable for cognition in general must hold just as much for everyone and hence must be just as universally communicable as any determinate cognition, since cognition always rests on that relation as its subjective condition. So what Kant is here arguing is that the really big deal is about the harmony between the understanding and the imagination. That's what underlies the whole thing. And why is that a universally communicable state? It's a universally communicable state because, and this is his hypothesis, which we'll see doesn't quite bear out, but this is the aim, and this is what we already talked about when we talked about reflective judgment. namely that the harmony between the understanding and the imagination in this case provides all the subjective conditions necessary for an objective judgment, but without any concepts being involved. That is, without concepts. Now we know what without concepts being involved means technically. It means without particular concepts determining the imagination by the understanding. So without a concept means that we're not subsuming the imaginative synthesis or determining it by a concept, but just letting the demands for unity emerge from the imagination itself. So harmony, in this sense, the free play, is one that is literally unconstrained by interest, that is, by the interest of any need to generate a cognition. Now, if that's the case, then we can distinguish, and this is the crux for Allison, harmony from free play. So the thought is the following. Free play is going to be equal unconstrained by interest. Now, the free play of the imagination and the understanding can be either harmonious, yielding pleasure, or not harmonious, yielding displeasure. Hence, the possibility of negative judgments of taste. So you can have free play without harmony, and that is, the object is ugly. Or you can have harmony without free play, in which case what you have is a cognition. Okay. Now, that at least explains why Kant takes the question of universality in this section. He explains it by indeed a universally communicable state. But he thinks the idea of a universally communicable state to be one that is an anticipation, right, the subjective side, of objective cognition. So we have traced the subjective universality affirmed in judgment of taste to the harmony of the faculties. And we've explained why the harmony of the faculties should be a universally communicable state, even though we haven't proved it yet. That is, what we're missing up to now, here's the question, that is the question of the deduction of taste. Why should we assume that the free play of the understanding and the imagination is the subjective conditions of possibility for objective judgment? That is, why should we assume that once we, as it were, stop demanding the work of the imagination understanding operate in accordance with conceptuality, that we're actually still in the same ball game as cognition in general? Why do we think of that as cognition in general? And Kant's answer to that is what he gives in his deduction. But the harmony of the faculties for Kant in their free play, Kant takes to be the only conceivable source of subjective universality. Having said that, Kant at this point, and this is why this was Karen's point now, you might say Kant should now be ready to discuss necessity, but he doesn't. Rather, at 218, he asks a different question, namely, how do we become aware of the harmony of the imagination and the understanding? And he gives the answer we already know, pleasure. And then suddenly, I mean, not mentioning necessity again, goes on to purposiveness. So this is why it's a three-quarter interpretation. It doesn't quite... It hints at universality without truly... and gives an interpretation of why we might think of judgments of faith as related or bearing on universality, because they bear on a relationship to cognition, namely as its subjective conditions, but that's all. I can see you're all puzzled. Why are you puzzled?
I'm just wondering, so maybe the necessity step will take care of this, but so an aesthetic state is harmony into the determination of concept. And what you said about when that free play doesn't end up with harmony and being displeasure, that's really fascinating. He doesn't go there. I don't understand why. I mean, we know now full well that displeasure can also be an aesthetic state, right?
Well, he also has a notion of not all displeasure is the same. There's something called the sublime,
right,
which begins in pain, which I take to be a form of displeasure. So we're going to have to discriminate. Now, one of the questions I will come back to in a moment is Kant radically separates the beautiful and the sublime. Well, that is the question. Should he? Can he? Must he? What's the relationship between beauty and sublimity? And that's obviously kind of 2-3 weeks away.
Also, yeah. How free is the free play?
And how free is the free play? Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah,
Doc.
I'd like to ask maybe the same question in a different way. I think I'm missing a step somewhere, because if pleasure is unity,
it's harmony.
Harmony, sorry. It's harmony. Then anytime I'm not experiencing pleasure, or anytime I'm not experiencing harmony, I'm experiencing displeasure.
No. Your mental states usually, I don't know about you, but for most of us, mental states are not either sources of pleasure or displeasure.
Right, that's what I'm not.
Because the pleasure has to do with finding harmony that is unconstrained. It's finding harmony when it is no longer necessitated. So the harmony is pleasurable because I find pleasure where it is without any answering to any need or purpose or anything else, just for its own sake. And I'll say a bit about that, but that's why the pleasure of the aesthetic is kind of shocking, right? Kind of uprooting, because this is another way of talking about what disinterestedness is about, is because it doesn't seem to be for the sake of anything other than itself. So it seems to be a pleasure about the affirmation of pleasurableness. Aesthetics has this self-referential feature to it. Come back to that 7 or 8 minutes. Yeah.
I don't quite understand the free play between the imagination and the understanding. I can understand what imagination brings to it, and it seems to me that here's a case where the imagination is not being sucked into the machinery that you understand. I don't understand what understanding brings to this free play, other than not doing it.
Great. No. The harmony is the harmony of you're absolutely right, so let's get this clear. The imagination is doing 98% of the work here. Okay, so it's the workhorse. What does the understanding do? It's providing the imagination with the notion of unity as what its synthetic activities are about. So the harmony is between the imagination's activity and the demand or the expectations of the understanding. So they come into harmony by the imagination all by itself, shall we say, meaning everything that's necessary for understanding without the understanding demanding or dictating or anything else. So the notion of free play is really a free play of imagination with itself, but under, let's say, the shadow of the idea of the understanding. Now, again, I will offer three interpretations of the harmony next week. By the way, they're not going to be mine, so if you want to kind of read ahead, it's an article actually by Guire in the Kukla volume called The Harmony of the Faculties. Yeah?
It seems like on that account, 99% of the judgments made are logical judgments rather than studying judgments, because it's particularly based on subsuming based on the concepts of being different genres. You know, a painting is given to you inside a frame, and you're already coming to an expectation as to it's inside a certain narrative. So,
right. Okay, let's just say that we're going to take up all those questions about the role of conceptuality in those judgments, and they come up under two places. First, if we get there today, under the question of the relationship between pure judgments of taste and what are called dependent or accessory or impure judgments of taste, or adherent judgments of taste, arbitrary. So that's one place. And the other is exactly another question of the harmony of faculties. So there is this question that's been bugging a lot of people all along, what is the role of conceptuality? And we're getting there. And I've got to show what's going on so that obvious things, like I'm reading a poem, I'm looking at a painting, the painting's in a frame, I'm judging this F to be beautiful. Right? Well, yeah. So we've got to explain how the different moments articulate. My claim is the work of beauty is nonetheless going to have this free play character. The F is going to be simply a precondition of it. But there's a lot to say here. I just don't want to anticipate it. Let's leave that as a real worry. Yep.
Can you say that, I think you're trying to derive free play from the object, that like objects have certain resistance to a singular conception, art objects, and that maybe it's a sort of contradictory conceptual interpretations?
That will turn out to be one interpretation of free play, of the harmony of the faculties. A too muchness rather than a minimalness. So we can see why. And one reason, let me just back up what you've just said. One of the puzzles we want to think about is one of the things that distinguish aesthetic objects is they're supposed to be deep, where deep means, in a certain sense, inexhaustible. Unlike, say, a mathematical statement, which is perfectly exhaustible. That is, we can't have enough of it. There's always more to be found. And we have to understand how that's possible on this model. So I absolutely agree. That's one of the issues we're heading toward. Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering, is there, we're thinking of harmony and called disharmony as a matter of kind. Is it possible to consider it as a matter of degree? Or is that cognitive?
No, it wouldn't be cognitive. It certainly looks as if you could think of harmony and disharmony as along a continuum. I don't see obviously why not. where, you know, emphatically beautiful and emphatically ugly are the extremes, and you get all sorts of stuff in the middle, you know, which is, you know, oh, isn't that just charming? Damning with faint praise. Still gotta be, it's just over a weak pleasure, almost a velity, right? You know, that sort of thing. Or even maybe the idea that if I was a bit more sensitive, I'd feel pleasure, but I'm a beast and then. You
know? This was kind of the question, because it seems like there can be a continuum of displeasure for like the lack of harmony. But once you have harmony, you either have it or you don't. It seems like there can be different degrees of displeasure. So the question I was asking before is whether or not in this we're experiencing the pleasure, or just experiencing different degrees of displeasure.
I don't think so. I don't have a great direct answer, but here's my intuition. And it seems to me right as I think about poems or painting. I often say, it doesn't quite work. Now, when it doesn't quite work, which I say about a lot of works, it's not that I'm not in a state of ugliness. I'm much closer to a state of pleasure, but I'm saying that something that would make me enthusiastic about my own pleasure is missing. Right? And I can often even, you know, critically point to, you know, that, you know, it overreaches, or the one Kant points to, he says, too geometrical. How much of modern art do we think, oh, it's just too geometrical, too neat? And of course, there's a certain challenge in that, right? A whole bunch of people called minimalists and try to exactly attack Kantian formalism on that basis, right? That's the whole point about why minimalists thought they were getting at Greenberg. It's the whole story there. But, and they wanted to say, you know, you're wrong about that. But so it does seem to me that we can still, you know, make partial judgments, because harmony can be partially achieved. Yeah.
Is the free play just
No. Yeah, I can't quite see where the puzzle is. I can't see quite what's hurting.
Nothing's really hurting.
Well, then I'm doing something wrong. It's got to be different in kind because of the free play. So it's setting imagination free from its usual servitude, right? Which is certainly something that's important here, right? And it's finding resources within itself to achieve a kind of unity that normally is only achieved when it is working at the behest of a particular concept. So the pleasure really has to do with, and that's why, in a certain sense, you may say the pleasure, which Kant does say, the pleasure in aesthetic judgments are unanticipated, as if unintended. Adorno says somewhere, beauty can only be glimpsed, never seen. I think he's getting at that thought that once you see it, it's almost as if you're determining it, right? And it's the idea that you catch it, and it catches you by surprise because you are not in control. So it's that lack where the understanding has not, as it were, set the terms of the encounter. help?
So would displeasure then be the failure of the imagination to provide or to meet the requirements of unity with the understanding?
Absolutely.
So it's disunity.
Yeah.
Are we the...
Yeah. It's a form of disunity, a kind of disunity. There are other kinds. The starry heavens being, right, and that's going to be the sublime. And then it's going to fail, but it's going to fail because not of a lack in the object, but because of a too muchness in the object. Kant's going to say.
Yeah. So what would be your Kantian story about contemporary art in which disunity and dissensus is, and it's not sublime, right? So it's not that type of book. It's a separate question. I mean, how...
Can you give an account of what you're thinking of?
Well, I mean,
just help us out.
Think of... I think there's an enormous amount of contemporary art which one finds, I guess maybe one would just say, well, one doesn't find that beautiful, one finds it interesting or thrilling or intellectually exciting, or maybe that's simply the answer, but...
This really just goes back to the question about the relationship between beauty and sublimity. And we can at least put that in the form of a straightforward question. And here's the straightforward question, to which we'll see if we can find an answer sometime in the next... How many weeks do we have left? 8 weeks, something like that? What?
Many.
Many, good. Because we've gotten nowhere so far. So the question would simply be this. Is beauty possible without a moment of dissonance? That do it as a question?
Yes.
That is the question. Okay. So we want to have that. I'm not going to answer it now, but yes, please.
I have a question. Like, if you have an artist and his project is to create a work of art, so he has interest in creating it, so how that can produce this interested pleasure?
And we're going to have a long story about art, and that's why we're having 3 weeks on it or whatever. So... Yeah, I mean, it depends what you create. I mean, you know. Look,
can he have this interest, just the pleasure in his work?
I mean, the answer, think of it this way. The simple answer is yes, for all the reasons that altruism is possible. Just because I do it, and I want to do it, doesn't mean I'm doing it for my personal pleasure, right? That assumes a reductive notion of, you know, you have to get satisfaction from everything you do, which is an empiricist theory of action and desire. So it depends what the artist creates. He can create an object for which people can get disinterested pleasure. We don't care about his motives. Maybe he made it just to get rich. That's not an issue. The issue is simply... what kind of pleasure does it generate?
Isn't there something on that in the first intro? He's talking about the internal, right? So you can use a certain style to produce a certain effect, but that doesn't corrupt the ability to see as beautiful.
Right.
So you can have the creator that can have a dual relationship to...
He doesn't even have to have a dual. He may have an interest in nothing but my only, you know, think of Jeff Koons, right? You have a lot of artists. I have nothing but I just want to be famous and rich. How do I do that? And I'm just going to create objects that everyone's going to think are beautiful. And I've got a way of thinking how to do it, right? Well, I think that's what goes on in a lot of art schools, right? That worries us sometimes. But it doesn't mean they can't produce objects that are fully capable of pure, whatever their motives are, of satisfying our highest aesthetic.
But knowing their motives...
Well, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter. So you know, what if we learn that Gates is a very religious guy and he's doing all this so he can be sainted? It doesn't matter. He's saving thousands of lives in Africa. The fact that he's doing it from, you know, low motives doesn't mean he's not saving lives. Right? So motives are a kind of uninteresting thing, is what I'd say to you. And that's what Hegel says. What's the phrase? Anyone to do Hegel? Every hero
has
his valet. And you can always look at anything from the point of view of subjective interest. It's uninteresting. It's not how you judge the action or the object by the motives of the producer. You judge it by how it enters the world and what it can do in the world. Okay, let's press on because we have our third interpretation. And the third interpretation, as Grace knows, is going to be the two pleasure thesis. And it comes from Longuenesse. So what Longuenesse is going to do, this is in her essay on the leading thread, and what she's going to do is affirm everybody. It's capacious, right? She's going to say Ginsburg is right, but in a way, so is Guire, and in a way, so is Allison. She doesn't mention any of these names, but she does mention Ginsburg. She actually thinks, because the Ginsburg is so peculiar, that thesis couldn't belong to anyone else. So here's the way she interprets the Ginsburg moment. She says that, and this should now be easy for us, she says that the universal communicability of the capacity to be shared of a mental state in apprehending the object, it's that, the universal communicability, that elicits the pleasure proper to the judgment of taste. And she thinks that pleasure is taken in this universal communicability of our state of mind in judging an object is a primitive fact that justifies aesthetic pleasure as disinterested. So she's saying two things, right? She thinks that what's called the Ginsburg self-referentiality is a primitive of our human self-relation in our relationship to the world. Remember, oh God, that all this is variation on Descartes. And the reason all this is variations on Descartes. Because what Descartes said is that our relationship to the world is grounded in a primitive self-relation. Right? Descartes did the Copernican turn. That's what the cogito is. Right? The cogito is a mini Copernican turn, right, that he then spins out in a very objectivist way. But the absolute gesture is Copernican. Right? And to say that, then you must say that there must be, as it were, primitive forms of self-relation that ground our capacity to relate to the world. And in a way, that's what Longuenesse is underlining in her picking up of the Ginsburgian thesis. So that for her, what is important here is that this self-referentiality is itself the primitive fact about, so it's a primitive form of human self-relatedness, And it alone justifies the idea of aesthetic pleasure as disinterested. So she's really agreeing down the lines with Ginsburg, because she's claiming that reversing the direction of interest, namely, it is not disinterested pleasure that grounds universal communicability, but universal communicability that grounds disinterested pleasure. And it is this pleasure, right, that grounds the judgment, this is beautiful. Okay. So far, straight Ginsburg. Step two. Longuenesse notes that aesthetic judgments are not the only judgments that are universally communicable. As she points out in the Prolegomena, and I should say Longuenesse is almost unique among contemporary Kant scholars in taking the Prolegomena seriously. Most of the rest of us are embarrassed by it. She thinks that it really is a prolegomena, and it really is the clue to the right reading of the first critique. In the Prolegomena, Kant distinguishes judgments of perception from judgments of experience. A judgment of perception is something like the judgment, this stone feels warm. So I'm just recording, in the judgment of perception, how the stone feels to me. Perfectly private judgment. A judgment of experience would transform the judgment of perception by into the statement, the stone is warm, or even the sun warms the stone, something like that. And that's made possible, the movement to universality, by, well, the entire apparatus of the a priori categories. It's the cognitive capacities that ground it. Now, we don't, so that universal communicability can be had in one way simply through cognition. That's her simple point. If there is a judging that precedes the pleasure, then she argues it must be an act of reflecting upon the object. This is her Guire moment. And the reason why that's important is because it is only in reflecting upon the object that the imagination and understanding are put into play. And it's only in reflection upon the object that what is elicited is a mutual agreement between those two faculties. Because in this case, no concept can possibly account for my experience. This is just the point that Adam was worried about at the break. How are we going to account for this? What has to be accounted for, right, by the business of reflection without conceptualization? Only then can we say that the only thing that can account for this experience is the mutual enhancing and enlivening and agreement of imagination and understanding. But if we use the language of mutual enhancing and enlivening and agreement between imagination and understanding, then we have a second pleasure. So it seems to be the case that an aesthetic judgment not involved two acts. Guire's mistake was not to see that it involves two different kinds of pleasure. So Longuenesse says on page 207, the pleasure is twofold. That's what I'm saying. So it's the first order pleasure, this one, we take in the mutual enlivening of imagination and understanding. That's what Kant calls the free play of the imagination and understanding. But, she says, that pleasure alone, the pleasure of reflection, is not sufficient to constitute our experience of what we call aesthetic pleasure of reflection, pleasure in the beautiful. Another constitutive feature of aesthetic pleasure is the sense that the mutual enlivening of imagination and understanding in apprehending the object and the first order pleasure it elicits could and ought to be shared by all. This sense of universal communicability, of a pleasurable state of mutual enhancement in imagination and understanding, is the source of a second-order pleasure. And it's the second-order pleasure that results in the judgment, this is beautiful. So what she does is take Guire and then literally subsumes the Guire under the Ginsburg, so that it's true that the aesthetic pleasure proper is only the pleasure you get from the judgment of the universal communicability, but that itself is dependent on an antecedent pleasure in aesthetic reflection on the object. The best of both. Now, this is immensely attractive because it solves all the problems, but for one simple fact. I have no experience of judging a work and feeling two distinct pleasures. That is, it sounds great. I mean, you know, her solution is let all the flowers bloom, let everyone be right, but the two-pleasure thesis seems to be just one pleasure too many. I just can't locate that second pleasure. So what she doesn't convince us of is how one pleasure is either subordinated in another pleasure, or they're But she actually says, in order to make the argument really do all the heavy lifting it wants to do, it seems as if she needs both pleasures to be kind of both distinct and related, as if pleasure is doubling itself, pleasure upon pleasure, as the structure of it. But that is not quite what the notion of preserving the mental state, that could have been what she was thinking about, does. So I can't quite see how that could be right. Yeah.
Why can't it be two dimensions of one pleasure? So when you have the threefold synthesis, it's not like you have three distinct syntheses, but it's one act, in a sense.
Because she's got to give relative autonomy to the two moments, or she slips back into Ginsburgian self-referentiality.
Why couldn't it be like what I think Katie was talking about, where you have this this attention, this initial gesture, and there's just pleasure in that, pure pleasure in that, because you know, I mean, only if you have to know after the fact that it delivers over understanding, you know, delivers over the aesthetic, the second pleasure. So you can have this, just this kind of comportment as the first pleasure.
But it's got to yield the pleasure. So I'm not, you're, what you're describing is exactly, I think, what Longinus wants. And all I'm suggesting is, I'm simply phenomenologically and just commonsensically, I just don't think we think about as two pleasures. And yet she needs both in order for the theory to, you know, I've kind of corresponded with her about this, and she's, you know, thinks I'm wrong, and, you know, anyway, but as soon as I read it, I said, Beatrice, blah, 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 blah. She said, blah, 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 blah. So. Yeah.
I guess I don't really get what's totally wrong with Weyer's argument, and it seems to me that this pleasure, the pleasure, was that universal of the making the universalizable thing. I mean, that seems almost a pleasure that would take place, like even in speaking or in discursive, in like just any sort of universalizable sensation. And yeah, so I what was your criticism of Weyer?
Criticism of Guire, as I read from Kant, that it makes all the fundamental stuff merely psychological, and that the normative stuff simply tracks the psychological. So the normative is simply a shadow of, let's call it, in causal theories of perception. The general drift of them says something like the following. You are reliably seeing an object as red if and only if your relationship to the object follows a normal causal path, right? And if it follows a normal causal path, then you are entitled to say it is red. And then, of course, what I love about this stuff is if it follows a deviant path, it goes around a mirror and through a darks, you know. Then, right, so, but the point there is, it looks, and that's what Guire's is kind of like. He wants it to have the right kind of ideology. If it is, if the state comes about in the right psychological way, under the right conditions, then I'm entitled. So it's kind of a causal theory of that. And that, you know, and what that does, and the argument against that is, then it's not truly normative, then what you're getting is an ideal prediction. And that, now you might say, damn it, that's what I think aesthetic judgments are, ideal predictions, they don't carry normativity. And then we have a debate about the grammar of aesthetic judgments. So, of course, you can always go that way, but that's the cost. Yeah.
So would it be possible for Longinus to give us an account of having one of these first-order pleasures and deciding that it can't make the cut for the second-order for universal communicability and therefore not give a second-order pleasure? I mean, would that... What would that be?
One of the things it might be is someone without any aesthetic culture. That is, that they get little aesthetic twinges of pleasure, but because, for example, their life is so harsh and difficult, that they're not going to say, oh, it's beautiful. Then, you know, that's just a distraction between finding the next meal. So judgments of taste are about the about doing something with those judgments in a certain way, and therefore understanding them as having a certain pertinence. So certainly you can disaggregate them. And if you disaggregate them in the other direction, then you get the kind of crazy, your worry almost about, well, it's pure self-assertion. Something's missing in a constraint by the world, anyway.
But I mean, I'm not saying just me failing to make that reflective judgment, but if these are supposed to be sort of two moments, I know I don't actually go through the mental process of saying, oh, it does this or doesn't it. But if someone with aesthetic culture, is it possible for them to have the first order pleasure and it doesn't make the cut? Or do they not ever have the first order pleasure unless it's also simultaneously going to be universally communicable and therefore able to the second order pleasure?
Well, this is not coercion. I'm not sure what the purport of the question is. We're not talking about psychological propensities. we're talking about the distinct moments. I mean, these are still acts. These are acts for Longuenes, and they have, and that what she's saying is we can't think about aesthetics without thinking about both kinds of acts if we're to hold on to a Kantian outlook. That's the power. If we thought there was something deep about how Ginsburg was trying to pull out the normative moment, then we might, and if that moment looks like the truly Copernican moment, then we need both moments. We need both the right kind of relationship to the object to get all this stuff going, but then we need the reflective bit and the universal communicability to make that, as it were, a matter of not just psychological states, but how we ought to be responding to those states. Yeah?
Is there not a more economical solution to this problem, which is what Kant gives in section 12, where he says the very consciousness of a uniform of purposes is that pleasure? So it's not, you don't have to presuppose a pleasure that comes before, it is that. So that solves the puzzle of does the pleasure come before, but it also has to come after because that's the very definition of disintegration. It is that, so it comes neither before nor after.
Oh, but that's roughly, that's what Guire is saying.
No, Guire says that the free play between the faculty causes a pleasure.
Uh-huh. Rather than it is the pleasure.
Yeah, that solves the problem of it coming before, because it doesn't come before, it comes with.
Right, that would get you out of the causal, but would still leave you with a question of why isn't just psychological ideology? In other words, what you've done is say, look, as long as this is a judging, a real judging, and that judging is, you know, find the act of judging, this is the pleasure, right? That will give you that fact as judgment. Longuenes is agreeing with you. She's not going all the way to Guire. She's really taking this to be judgment. So it's not the causal problem. It's the ideology problem.
What would be the problem again, sorry?
That all you have at this level, right, is a correct adjustment of the individual to the object, and the second order is just a reflective account of what's been accomplished at the first order, and then you have to explain why you're going to give that kind of weight to the first moment. So the question still is the source of normativity. It's the source of normativity that we're arguing about.
Can't the source of normativity just come from the fact that if you can make those judgments, then you should be able to feel this? Like, you have those faculties, therefore you must should feel it.
Ah, but now you've gone completely wire. That's exactly... No, because the should there now is just anyone who's properly equipped, placed in front of the object, should feel this. That's not normative. That's a reasonable prediction based on the makeup of the human psychology. Now, let me just always say, if you want to be a naturalist about beauty, that is the way to go. Right? You may think that beauty is a absolutely simple, hardwired natural response of a certain kind based on the structure of our psychology. And just drop all the Kantian malarkey about normativity. The reason, there are two reasons, I mean, so that is, and that's essentially what Humean theories do. that's outside in the new school, you will discover that actually is the way that most estheticians talk. And that is philosophers of art. Most of them are Jungians. I hate reading Germans. Kant has two thoughts. One is a grammatical thought. So then the question is the grammar of beauty truly normative, or is it merely predictive? Right? And the second, which we'll come to next week, is there some notion of aesthetic community that is bound up with the issuing of judgments of taste? That is the notion of the sensus communis. Does using beauty talk, as it were, involve us in the generation of a community of sense that is itself truly community, that is, a form of community that is based on the acknowledgement of shared norms of appropriateness and not merely norms of habit or psychological propensity? Yeah?
So we can't kind of have both, like, relocate instead of A underneath B, relocate that communal B, like, into, like, as one of those conditions of A, that is the same thing.
Conflate every form of universality with real normativity. Right? Not all, some universality, for Kant, it always has a normative source, but some of the sources are, just categories.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that rather than take A as saying that it's just having a particular psychological makeup, let's assume that that psychological makeup is a function of ideology.
But then you just get determinism. Who cares about that? That's the way. That's Rorty. That's the way we judge things around here. So I've been habituated into aesthetically saying, something implausible. Richard Prince does aesthetically beautiful objects. The most ugly show of art ever in New York.
But without a reductibility of that universality, of that communal ideology.
But you just did that to do all the work. Where's the work going to be done? The question is, how is the normative work to get accomplished? Either you think it's hardwired, some form of naturalism, or you think there's some other way of doing it. Ginsburg's way of doing it, one way of doing it, Plato's, Kant's own way in every place else other than the Third Critique is a subjectivized Platonism. Put all that universal stuff in the head and then have people use it, right, in order to structure their way around the world. In the Third Critique, he suddenly goes weirdly Aristotelian, right, where he wants to say actuality precedes possibility. That is, my relationship to this object is going to be the basis on which I generate some authoritative, normative standard. And he's actually going to give it a particular title, this kind of universality. He's going to call it exemplary, which is we'll talk about next week. So there really are real questions here. So what we're trying to think about, and we'll have to stop because I think the shoot is something like that. But what we're trying to think about is a non-natural and non-Platonic form of encountering objects in a normatively authoritative way. But that's just Kant. Between empiricism and rationalism, is there another way to encounter the world that is gets real normativity without Platonism? It doesn't go back to either reductive naturalism or nominalism. Okay.
We'll start there next week.
Oh, yeah?